Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia, and it's the 9th of April 2012. My name's Herewood Fenton, glad you could join us. Truth News Radio Australia beams out from Sydney, Australia, and we also broadcast live on the Logos Radio Network out of Austin, Texas every week. Well, today I've got a number of stories to bring to you from the Australian scene, and I've got some audio clips I want to play and also some interviews that I did back in February when I was on the Skid Row radio show here in Sydney. So we've got a bit of a mixture of stuff today, quite a lot of audio material that I want to share. And I do hope you find it interesting. Some things here that I found particularly interesting was this little documentary that came from Brisbane that was made about the Occupy movement in Brisbane, and it's called Occupying Brisbane. And it's very interesting because I found the way the film was made was very genuine, and the people who started the Occupy movement in Brisbane seemed to me like they were coming from a really good place. But then the film documents how some things went a bit off the rails as the group started to be co-opted by political forces that are more part of the sort of mainstream political activist networks. And then the original organizers of that movement basically gave up. But first, I want to go through some Australian news. And we've got a few stories here on climate change and the carbon tax, which I think are pretty important. First off, I want to read to you from an article which was published in the Sydney Morning Herald on April the 6th. The title of the story is "The Final Frontier of Climate Policy: Remake Humans." A radical proposal to modify physique and behavior in response to climate change has been greeted with outrage. Yes, folks, this is all about sort of re-engineering the human being to be more suited to, lowering the overall carbon footprint of humanity. But it also, I mean, that's bad enough. But the impact of the story also seems to be to create a different type of human being that will have, behavioral attributes that we want. And so this is really a type of a eugenics plan. This is blatant, in-your-face eugenics. And I'll just continue to read here from the article. "If it is so hard to change the climate to suit humans, why not alter humans to suit the changing climate? Philosophers from Oxford and New York universities are asking. It seems, are we having an open season here for crazy, deranged philosophers to sort of come out of the closet? Because, I mean, we had the story on afterbirth abortion, also from so-called philosophers a few weeks ago, which we covered on this show. And now we have an equally crazy idea from some philosophers. They suggest that humans could be modified to be smaller, dislike eating meat, have fewer children, and be more willing to cooperate with social goals. Behavioral changes, though, might not be enough to prevent climate change, even if they were widely adopted. And international agreements for measures such as emissions trading are proving elusive, say Matthew Liao of New York University and Anders Sandberg and Rebecca Roach of Oxford University. So, human engineering deserves serious consideration in the debate about how to solve climate change." And they write this in a journal called Ethics, Policy and Environment. Now, it says here, "A person's ecological footprint is directly correlated to size, because larger people eat more than lighter people." Fair enough. I mean, you can't really disagree with that. They suggest hormone treatments could be used to suppress child growth, or embryos could be selected for smaller size. Now, the article continues on. Oh, here's another one. Pharmacological treatments such as the love drug oxytocin could encourage people to act as a group and boost their appreciation of other life forms and nature, the authors say. So, yes, it's quite incredible. Now, in the article, there is a little cartoon here, and the cartoon features what looks like a scientist holding a test tube, and the caption is genetically modifying humans to solve climate change. And then the speech bubble from the scientist is, first we extract the conspiracy theory gene. Now, there's no mention of conspiracy theories in the rest of the article, but the cartoon hints again at an even deeper and darker and more ghastly implication of what they're talking about here. They really are talking about Aldous Huxley meets George Orwell. You know, they're talking about, you know, just full-on drugging, re-engineering of humanity, and creating a population which is adaptive and which is nice. And no doubt that also means docile and passive. But typically with typical of this type of polemic, we find at the end that there is actually a double twist and a kind of a retraction of the central thesis, which is the headline of the story. And it says here at the end, the authors emphasize that they are not advocating human engineering be adopted, only that it be considered. And they also envisage it as a voluntary activity, possibly supported by incentives such as tax breaks. Now, I do have some questions about this, how this could be a voluntary activity. How do we get an embryo to volunteer to be interfered with? Because basically they were saying that we could interfere with embryos to make them smaller and change children in various ways to be more willing to cooperate with social goals. There's a kind of a complete doublethink contradiction in the way the article presents this information, which of course is typical of the sort of polemic that comes with this fascist type ideation. But anyway, I'll leave this one with you. It's one of the most egregious, shocking, you know, disturbing articles I've ever seen, and it's just out there. You know, people will just read it and move on, and it'll just be absorbed into the mass psyche like all the others. Like, you know, the films we saw of little kids being blown up who didn't agree with climate change, and the stories about, you know, killing babies at birth to help the planet. It's all just a continuum with that. And, you know, one day I'd like to get it all together and actually have an expose, maybe actually have a film night expose where we just present a collage of all these incredible, insidious, fascist tendencies that have come through in the mainstream media over the past few years. Okay, the next story I want to consider is one that is actually presented as a science article. And I actually want to analyze it. I want to kind of use it as a case study in deception in presentation of information in the news. The title of the story from the ABC Science Division is Carbon Dioxide Ended the Last Ice Age. And, you know, you read that title, you read that headline, and you go, my goodness, you know, so finally we know that that carbon dioxide really is the bad guy. You know, it says scientific study, you know, shows that carbon dioxide ended the last ice age. And, you know, the really interesting thing about this article is that when you read it, and you read it right through, it's another case where the actual substantive content of the article completely clashes with the headline. But this is a technique that is used over and over again in the mainstream media. It's how they actually put propaganda out there, because they have to carefully sort of disguise the disinformation with real information so that they can say, well, we're just a news source here, and we're not you know, basically promoting false information. But quite often it's done with the juxtaposition of a headline with other content, and then various amounts of spin put around that content, so that when you read it, you get a certain impression in your mind, which is quite different from the actual information that's being imparted. Now, let me just explain it. I'm going to go through it. Carbon dioxide ended the last ice age. Study. Carbon dioxide was the big driver that ended the last ice age, according to a new study of ice core data from around the world. About 10 to 20,000 years ago, the Earth started to emerge from a 250,000 years of deep freeze as the terrestrial ice sheet rolled back and warmer temperatures prevailed. What caused the end of this age, known as the Pleistocene, has long been debated. Until now, the main evidence has come from ice cores drilled in Antarctica, whose air bubbles are a tiny time capsule of our climate past. Traces of CO2 in Antarctic ice show that carbon concentrations in the atmosphere rose after temperatures were on the rise. Now, I wouldn't disagree with any of that. You know, that's all just straightforward information. And it goes on to say here that a new technique has been used. Actually, not a new technique. It is actually just... I thought it was a new technique. Fuck. Traces of CO2 in the Antarctic ice, it says, show that carbon concentrations in the atmosphere rose after temperatures were on the rise. And this, of course, we know. Though, you know, people who've looked at films like The Great Global Warming Swindle know that, and they know that this is actually a major dent in the views that were put forward by Al Gore in the film An Inconvenient Truth, which misrepresented the timeline and made it look as if the CO2 rises preceded the warming periods, when in fact they came after. So far, what they're actually presenting here is information which actually clashes with the accepted IPCC mainstream science on climate change. But they're actually trying to put a twist on it here. And it says here in a new study published in Nature that the Antarctic record does not reflect global temperature rise. So they're basically saying, well, yes, this information that we got from Antarctica is not actually, reflective of the overall climate in the planet. It's a special case. And, of course, they made that argument with the medieval warming period when, you know, heaps of subsequent studies had shown that the medieval warming period was not simply confined to Northern Europe, but that's the type of argument they ran. Anyway, we're going to break, but as soon as we come back from the break, I'll be straight back into this story. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back.
Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now.
Hi, welcome back. Well, today I'm going through some disinformation. I'm analysing here an article that was published in the ABC Science website, and I believe that this article is completely deceptive and was written with actually an intent to deceive. Of course, the title of the article being Carbon Dioxide Ended the Last Ice Age, and up to this point we've just been illustrating how in fact the evidence is that carbon dioxide levels follow periods of warmth, they do not precede it, And, you know, by the very definition of cause and effect, a cause cannot follow from something. A cause has to precede something for it to be a cause. I mean, this is basic logic here, folks. This is just you know, a six-year-old can understand that. And the article here confirms that, yes, it's true that carbon dioxide levels do go up after it gets warmer, as evidenced in Antarctica. They then refer to a study that was published in Nature, which indicates that the Antarctic record does not reflect global temperature rise. And this is where it gets really weird. The study is based on 80 ice cores and sedimentary samples taken from Greenland, lake bottoms, and seafloors on every continent. The data suggests that while changes in CO2 concentration did not trigger glaciation, they were either synchronous with or led global warming during the various steps of deglaciation. Now, did you get that? Did that go in? Because, you know, when I first read that, I had no idea what was going on and I got really confused. And then I had to read it like three times before I started to get it. Okay, so I'm going to read it to you again. Just that last paragraph. The data suggests that while changes in CO2 concentration did not trigger deglaciation, they were either synchronous with or led global warming during the various steps of deglaciation. Whew. Okay, now once more with feeling, okay. And we're going to break it down as we go through it. The data suggests that while changes in CO2 concentration did not trigger deglaciation. Now stop it right there. Just stop it right there, okay? Changes in CO2 concentration did not... Well, hang on. I thought the article was saying that carbon dioxide... Hang on, let's go back to the title again. Okay, go back to the top. Carbon dioxide ended the last ice age. Okay, all right, now I'm going back down here again. It says here, the data suggests that while CO2 did not trigger deglaciation. Hang on, that's not what they said in the title. Ah, gee. Okay, anyway, let's plow ahead. They were either synchronous with or led global warming. Gee, I mean, which is it? You know, wouldn't it be nice if we could just be, know one way or the other? I get really confused by that. During the various steps of deglaciation. Well, maybe they're saying sometimes it was like, what, like a little bit more, a little bit less? I mean, I can't figure it out. I mean, obviously, at the beginning, it was deglaciation that started the whole thing. It started the CO2 rising. And so something else triggered the deglaciation. And then the CO2 started rising. And then at different points, maybe it was warming and cooling as the CO2 continued to increase. Maybe that's what they're saying. But that doesn't seem to me like any kind of evidence that argues that CO2 triggered the global warming or caused the global warming. Now, just continuing here from the article, putting all these records together into a reconstruction of global temperatures shows a beautiful correlation with rising CO2 at the end of the ice age, says lead author Jeremy Shakun of Harvard University. A rise in carbon dioxide actually precedes a global temperature range, which is what you would expect if CO2 is causing the warming. Now, this phrase, global temperature range, completely blows my mind and just leaves me like a blubbering idiot because I have no idea what global temperature range means. I mean, obviously, I'm a lay person, but I mean, this article is supposed to be addressed to a general audience. So what does global temperature range even mean? It seems like a piece of gobbledygook. It seems like a phrase that is hiding something inside it. Now, the article gets more interesting as we go. It gets more strange. The study, it says, refutes theories by skeptics that natural changes in the Earth's orbit, bringing the planet closer to the sun, caused the warming and not a rise in CO2. Our study shows that CO2 was a much more important factor and was really driving worldwide warming during the last deglaciation. Orbital changes are the pacemaker. They're the trigger, but they don't get you too far. Now, just stop it right there, because that, again, that's another one of those points where I go, what's going on here? You're messing with my head, okay? Okay, let's read it again. Orbital changes are the pacemaker. They're the trigger. Whoa, stop it right there. Stop it right there. You just said, in the two paragraphs before, you said, the study refutes theories by skeptics that natural changes in the Earth's orbit, bringing the planet closer to the sun, caused the warming. Okay, you said that two paragraphs before. Now we'll go forwards again. And it says, orbital changes are the trigger. Oh, I'm going mad. It doesn't make any sense. I've lost my marbles completely. ABC, 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 we really need you to stop doing this. And we need to picket your offices. We need a protest that never stops outside your doors. And we need to confront you and your science writers and your little apparatchiks who are spouting out this mind-numbing drivel on your website. And you need to be called to account. And some of you need to go to prison. I'm sorry to say. There's got to be justice. There's got to be accountability. Because what you're doing is you're propping up a scam. You're propping up fraud. And it's hurting people. Okay, our third climate change story for today. Carbon tax bites labour. And this is from The Telegraph on the 4th of April 2012. Labour has now found it cannot meet its obligation to pay for its carbon dioxide tax compensation package. It has to slash public service jobs to shore up its dodgy budget and meet its promised compensation payments. Yes, folks, unfortunately, those amazing compensations that were offered to the poorer people in our community they've been finding it a little bit hard to actually find the money to pay for that, so they've decided to slash a whole bunch of other things. Anyway, let's get into it. The move highlights the dysfunctional nature of the ideology-driven Labour Green Independent Minority, writes Piers Ackerman, and the incompetence of Treasurer Wayne Swan. The ministers are under the pump to shrink their departments to help Wayne Swan meet his budget surplus goal. According to the Daily Telegraph's Simon Benson, all ministers have been asked to find cuts to pay for the carbon dioxide tax compensation package. Everyone is being asked to contribute to pay for this compensation package, one minister told him. But in the process, we are going to hit people even harder. The Australian reports that the Department of Climate Change will scrap up to 300 jobs, one-third of its workforce. Yes, that's right. Those people who are working tirelessly to save the planet, for some reason, 300 of them are no longer needed. Just when we're actually starting to move into the biting phase of saving the planet and lowering the Earth's temperature, they're going to just sack 300 people. Well, interesting. And maybe the work is already done. Maybe the goal has been achieved, and so we don't need those 300 jobs. What were they doing anyway all this time? Anyway, look, we're going to break, and we'll be back with more of this straight after these messages. Hi, you're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, a Australian-made, homegrown podcast which comes from the eastern seaboard of Australia in the metropolis known as Sydney. And Australia is a country that has a very small population for its landmass. But I should point out to those who are overseas that we are, you know, we are a very energy-intensive country because most of our GDP is actually occupied with the resource sector. Mining is a huge component of our economy, and aluminium smelting and a few other industries like that that actually have huge demands of electricity. And this is why the carbon tax has been met with such consternation by so many groups, industry groups in Australia, because it really does make it very hard to be competitive when the, you know, one of the main factors that makes your industry possible is then getting this extra tax imposed upon it. And then, of course, you know, the customers who buy these products can go to other countries that don't have that tax. And of course, you know, it kind of defeats the whole idea behind what the carbon tax was for. And again, it just is another layer of absurdity on top of the many layers of obfuscation and outright disinformation which makes up climate policy. But anyway, just getting back to what I was discussing here before, which was the fact that the government sold the carbon tax largely to the population on the basis of the fact that even though the prices of everything would be going up, they said, look, we're going to give you all these wonderful compensations. But of course, they targeted those compensations at very low income earners. And of course, people who are earning more than 80K don't really get any benefit from that at all. And that's, you know, that's the middle classes, and that's a huge sector of the population. They're not, you know, they're not the 1%, I assure you. People earning over 80K are not the 1%. No, no. I think if you're earning over 30 million, yeah, maybe you might be getting near that. I think it's really much higher than that. But I really think in terms of, you know, who the elites are, that are disproportionately wealthy, it gets up into the hundreds of millions or, you know, higher in terms of their yearly income. And there are people in a bracket that is so far beyond what we consider wealth that they are super elites. And they don't really think of money in the same way we think of money. But anyway, I'm getting distracted here. But of course, I mean, understand that this these taxes, it is all you know, a type of wealth redistribution. That is the real agenda that is going on here. And of course, it's not really addressing where the huge imbalances are. But anyway, in order to fund this amazing set of compensations that the Gillard government has brought to Australia, they've had to slash a whole lot of other programs. Now, it says here that the cuts relate to funding reductions previously ordered by Wayne Swan. And the Treasurer has pledged to return the government to surplus in 2013. Community and Public Sector Union National Secretary Nadine Flood warned that the cuts would damage a government service provision and demanded that the government rule out forced redundancies. These are massive cuts to staffing. Losing 20% of an agency's workforce must mean the government can no longer deliver the same functions. We are calling on the government to indicate what work would no longer be done by these agencies, and we're also asking government to maintain Finance Minister Penny Wong's commitment to avoid forced redundancies and protect services in regional Australia. The concerns from senior ranks of the government followed admissions by the dumped Minister Robert McClelland that the broken promise on the carbon tax was killing the government. Gillard has refused to rule out changes to the Medicare safety net and other middle-class welfare programs to bring the budget back into surplus for the coming year. Gillard earlier this week forecast more means testing of family payments to target those regarded as high earners. Treasurer Wayne Swan warned welfare for people who don't need it is dispensable. So not only... Gee, this show seems to be all about double negatives or just things that completely contradict themselves. I mean, we were told that the people who at the lower end who get welfare would be compensated handsomely for any costs associated with, you know, the carbon tax, which is going to make the cost of everything rise. But now we're being told that we might have more means testing, we might have restrictions on what people who are actually getting welfare can get. And they might start just sort of yanking back on your actual welfare entitlements. So it could be an exact contradiction and a cancelling out of whatever you got. But anyway, you voted for Julia. I mean, a lot of people out there voted for Julia. Of course, you believed it when she said there would be no carbon tax. You thought, well, a politician wouldn't just lie and, you know, it is a pre-election commitment. But anyway, you got your carbon tax, you got your compensation, but now your compensation might be just taken away. And that's all for the greater good, because remember, you are saving the planet. So, look, I'm not going to continue on the thread of the climate insanity any further. I'm now going to move to another type of scandal. And I'm going to bring you a clip here from a movie that was conducted in Brisbane over the last 3 months of 2011. Okay, the title of this documentary is Occupying Brisbane, Uniting the 99%. And it follows the course of the Occupy movement in Brisbane. And it contains interviews with a number of the people who started the movement. And it gets into some really interesting stuff towards the end, where they start to become somewhat overrun by other political groups with other agendas, particularly the socialist alternative and groups that really wanted to take the movement in a much more aggressive direction. And the original leaders of the group were basically pushed out, and they resigned from it. And this documentary sort of charts the course of that during that time that they were running it up until the final breakup by the police. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. Here it is, Occupying Brisbane.
I was born in Sydney. Military family, raised part of the time by foster parents, so I've had quite a mismatch of things. lived overseas on and off for quite a number of years, particularly in the United States, where my work took me. I'm mainly involved in the yachting industry. I design boats and yachting equipment, stuff like that. Also been into a lot of social projects, designing housing for poor people. To talk about my family, effectively they sit to the right of Genghis Khan. You know, we know the Howards through political connections, things like that, and I am what you would classify as the black sheep of the family. I used to be kind of that way inclined myself, but over a period of time I realised how damaging right-wing policies are for people. And it's just been a slow evolvement ever since then.
I probably represent the demographic of middle class. I grew up in a rural environment on the land. Yeah. I guess my family were sort of originally what used to be sort of National Party, I think, which used to basically represent the rural part of Australia. That demographic fell away. You know, I've sort of been caught in the illusion of voting for different political parties during my lifetime. I'd have to describe myself now, though, as a political atheist. I believe that because of the fact that corporations have now hijacked governments and democracy, that the political process is just there to create an illusion that people have a choice.
I grew up on a farm, actually, in South Australia. So I moved here when I was 20, and I started up my own company when I was 20. I was driven towards success and being successful, and got a, you know, be really successful and be really good. And, you know, because when I've got a lot of money and a lot of things and I'm really successful in business and, you know, have a lot of employees, then people will think that, you know, I'm worthy. And then the longer that I went along, I realised that I had all these things and I was in business for a long time, and I went, what's the purpose as to why it is that I'm doing what I'm doing? And, you know, I'm just creating all these websites and more things in the world that we don't need. What's the real purpose? And I didn't feel happy. Like, I had all these things and I just wasn't happy.
You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break for more news and commentary. Welcome back to the show. Today we're going through a documentary that was made in Brisbane. It's about the Occupy movement, and it chronicles the story that of the people who organised that group, and I thought it was really well made. I'm going to actually fast forward it now towards the end, where they summarise the factors that actually brought about the sort of collapse of the group. And I think that's actually the most interesting part of it. So we'll basically play that, and I may give you a few comments on it towards the end. So we'll just get back into the Occupying Brisbane mini documentary.
So we got up there, and the General Assembly that day went pretty good. There was a little bit of angst going on, particularly with a couple of people from the Socialist Alternative again.
I received a phone call saying, Kate, you've got to get down here now. The General Assembly's, I'll be completely transparent, is being hijacked by a political group. I went down to Queen's Park and there was a lot of division amongst the group. There were some people who had felt that the best approach was to have resistance with police, and some people were, well, no, we actually need to be peaceful and, you know, this is what this occupation is all about. So some people decided to stay and some people left. I believe that some of the people who decided to stay were the resistant people that wanted that type of interaction with the police.
Next thing, I got a phone call at 7 o'clock in the morning. It was on again, and it was getting pretty nasty, which is a shame.
And then from there, they were forcibly removed. I think there was about 20 arrests or something from there in Queen's Park. And then that night, then they went to Roma Street Parklands, and then they were all, and then they were evicted from there and issued with about $4,000 worth of fines.
As the original organisers, it's just not what we stand for. You know, we stand for a peaceful occupation. It's all about teaching people about what the occupation is about and sharing our knowledge and getting people involved. And when you act with resistance and violence, it's not how you get your message out. So we were speaking at that time about distancing ourselves from that type of behaviour.
Bags of memories, hit the road and taste and breathe.
Over the next 24 hours, we then decided to come back and to talk to the groups, because creating two separate groups is just it's not what it's about. It's about coming together as one in unity together and talking it out together and saying, hey guys, this is what we're feeling.
Yeah, and then the Friday night, of course, was the next General Assembly, and here we went with the Socialist Alternative again, where they put up a motion for myself and Kate not to speak at the rally.
They voted on whether we should speak the next day, and consensus said yes. So that was great to hear that they still had respect and acknowledgement for, I guess, the work that we had created in order to get the occupation moving along peacefully. It really reignited the core strength of why it is that we're here. So it was really good to see. It was really beautiful to see that strength coming back.
Sort of been through the mill, and we've come back and regrouped again, and we're forming relationships with the local Indigenous people in Musgrave Park. They've got a rally on this afternoon. They've asked us to join with them, and we're just, as far as the original organisers are concerned, we're just backing each other and going through the motions, moving forward and helping them and being there for the people as much as we can.
Well, obviously, you know, 100 people camped in the park isn't really going to change things, but it's an awareness thing to get everybody else on board, which is, you know, why we call, my badge is gone, which is why we call ourselves the 99%. You know, we represent everybody who's part of that 99%.
Once you get to a point, all you really have is civil disobedience. That's the only weapon that you have to use. And as soon as you give that up, you've got nothing at all. Whichever rights you're not prepared to stand up for, they're the rights that you'll end up losing.
Yeah, I've waited my whole life for this, to see something that has the possibility of making a change. I think this movement worldwide
can actually make a change. Where I don't know how that's going to come about. I can't see the politicians and the corporations, you know, just all of a sudden rolling over. You know, I think people all around the world know that these people that run these banks and these corporations that do the wrong thing, everybody knows that these people are morally and ethically bankrupt. And that's really what it comes down to. These people have got no conscience. So I don't see them rolling over very quickly. But where we go from here, I really don't know.
Einstein said this perfectly when he said, you cannot find the solution at the same level of what the problem was created at. So it's a start, which is brilliant, which is just what we need as a world anyway. We just need to start, and we just need to start somewhere.
Just reading here from the captions, after finding a home in Musgrave Park, the group struggled to stay unified. Allegations of drug use, political division, and violence plagued the movement, with one man ending up in hospital after an altercation between occupiers. Kate, Thomas, and Paul resigned from the movement on November 13. Citing the group's dwindling support and inability to maintain a peaceful environment as their core concerns. Now, there's obviously a lot of naive idealism involved in this group, and, you know, you can sort of be condescending towards it if you want, in the sense that, you know, they they didn't really understand the true nature of the forces that they were harnessing and the forces that were coming up against them. But I think that there's one part of this that's not well understood. And this is the way in which well-established political groups can completely take over movements. And with the Occupy movement, I actually think that it really was almost from the beginning a co-opted movement. And there were probably a number of different forces that combined to do that. But we saw that there were certain techniques being used in the Occupy movement which have been identified as what they call the Delphi technique by some. And this is actually a technique where they call it a consensus-building approach. But what actually happens is it's actually quite a sophisticated psychological technique, and it's actually a disruptive technique, and it's quite an underhanded one. And people who practice this technique can infiltrate into a group, and they do a number of things. They will often start by making quite hostile accusations against someone in the group who is already in the position of being a leader. And they will do it in such a way as to provoke the other person to respond. And when the other person responds, they'll try and then tarnish that person's reputation by making them respond in an aggressive way. And it's a way of taking someone down. And this is actually then combined with this consensus technique whereby you build a group consciousness. And it's very easy, if you understand the techniques and you understand the psychology, to actually manipulate groups. And particularly when you can set up a dynamic where you say, well, a certain person is actually being a problem, and then you provoke that person, you push their buttons, you get them to react against you, and then if you do it properly, what actually happens is that person comes off looking bad, you being the devious political, manipulator, actually then get into a position of power. And I think people in groups really need to understand that this happens. And the Delphi technique was, I believe, a technique which was developed in the US, and I think the Rand Corporation had something to do with it. And the Rand Corporation being a think tank for the powers that be in the establishment in terms of dealing with many issues, including wars and including internal instability in the US. But of course, I mean, the whole of the Occupy movement from the beginning appears to have been unable to gain momentum. I mean, unable to actually find what its real purpose was. And we saw this steering of it towards really a socialist agenda. I mean, we saw it steering towards a redistribution of wealth as a central concept. And of course, you could say, well, it sort of follows from this idea of the 1% versus the 99%. And I would agree with that. I would say that the core ideas within the Occupy movement, that the 1% versus the 99% is the problem, then becomes the pretext for the wealth redistribution paradigm, which really just ends up becoming another version of the sort of high taxation, centralized government, socialized nanny state type solutions that we already see. So it doesn't really become another alternative. And then, of course, in this case, we saw the socialists deliberately inject themselves into it and deliberately try and take it over. So, look, I hope you enjoyed that. The Occupy movement is obviously not completely dead, but it really seems to have gone into a terminal decline. And we need something that is truly alternative. We need something that comes not from people whose careers and whose background is in creating social media and social organizations. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Please stay with us. We'll be back after the break for hour two.